This Anderson Cloud podcast made by speaking telephone 702308. Here is an article on the herring fishing and drawn from some notes that was lying around here. I thought that perhaps when I was finished with it, I thought it might be suitable for either the cassette or the annual, however. As it may not be easy to make out my writing, I am recording it on a tape. Herring fishing. Early statements indicate that the inhabitants of the Scottish islands on the coastal region round about the north of Scotland practiced both agriculture and inshore fishing in small open boats from a very early date. Hence, the eventual development of our present crofting lifestyle period. As the Gaelic proverb indicates, "Eir muidhe hu," and it was quite natural for the local inhabitants of the islands on the coastal regions of Scotland to fish for their domestic requirements. Commercial fishing came much later. New Paragraph. It was the continental countries, particularly the Dutch, that dominated the commercial herring fishing industry in Scottish coastal waters in the 17th and 18th centuries. The Dutch fishing fleet were highly organized. It comprised of thousands of large vessels known as busses, B-U-S-S-E-S, period. These large fishing vessels remained at sea for months at a time, and they were serviced by a fleet of fast supply boats, which in turn rushed the herring catch to the continental market. The Dutch cured their herring at sea using their famous Dutch secret cure, which was invented by the Dutchman Pieter Brocheles, B-R-O-C-H-E-L-S, in 1736. The excellence of their salting cure enabled the Dutch to control the whole European market for salt herring. New Paragraph. The self-employed Scottish crofter fishermen did not have the resources to participate in the highly organized fishing methods of the Dutch, and in any case, probably, they felt it was more practical for them to operate in small open boats share-owned by the crews of independent people and working offshore and among the islands and sea lochs of Scotland, and landing their catch immediately in a fresh condition every morning. Fresh fish was by far the best way to supply the home market. And then there is a picture of small open boats. No paragraph. By the beginning of the 19th century, the long years of neglect and mismanagement of the British fishery was at last coming to an end. It was then that the herring industry in Scotland caught on, following the activities of a number of far-sighted people, as well as the incorporation of the British Fishery Society in 1786. The British Fishery Society helped greatly to lay the foundation of a very successful herring fishery. They set to work to develop fishing ports on west of Scotland, beginning at Tobermory in 1787 and at Doolabin in 1788. However, shortly after that, the hitherto plentiful shoals of herring suddenly deserted the west coast of Scotland, and the Fisheries Society decided to concentrate their attention on developing Wick Harbour, where fishing boats operated from suitable rock faces and beaches. Construction of Wick Harbour began in 1803, and by 1811 the original harbour was completed, and very soon it was packed to overflowing and quite inadequate for the number of fishing boats frequenting it, some from as far as Wales, Isle of Man, Shetland, and all round the coast of Scotland and the islands. In Lewis, the Seaforth proprietor and his taxmen launched an inshore Great Line white fishing industry towards the end of the 18th century period. Small fishing stations and salt houses were set up in almost every cove and sheltered creek from the coast, where the newly caught fish, mainly cod and ling, was salted and dried in the sun and wind on the pebbly beaches and rocks and exported to Ireland, etc. New paragraph. The Industrial Revolution raised the standard of living in the 18th and 19th centuries and created a demand for fish. By 1800, the population of Scotland had risen to 1,600,000. And both Glasgow and Edinburgh had 80,000 inhabitants each. The population of Lewes in 1755 was only 6,386 persons, but by 1821 it had doubled to 12,231 persons, and it went on increasing until it peaked at nearly 30,000 people at the beginning of the 20th century. New Palatine. It is said that the Hebrides were self-supporting in the 16th century, and even much later when Napier Commission were taking evidence from the crofters in 1883, John Smith Crofter Villallan testified that when his father was evicted from Sutherland Park to make room for the commercial park sheep farm, early in the 19th century, he was very comfortable. He said at question 17327, quotation, "Nobody needed to leave the place from one year's end to another for anything the family required." No wonder that King James VI and his five adventurers thought of exploiting the natural resources of Lewes earlier on, with headquarters at Stornoway, but they encountered the justifiable hostility of the islanders, and mercifully they were ignominiously ejected. The second half of the 18th and the first half of the 19th centuries were prosperous times in the Hebrides, when cattle, herring, dried salted fish, dogfish oil, blanketing, kelp, etc., and even whisky were exported to the European continent. Period. However, that was also the period that private land ownership was forcibly imposed on the Highland clansmen, and they suffered grievously under that system. Thereafter, there is an illustration of net making. New paragraph. Several things combined together to develop the herring fishing in Scotland. Period. The building of Portlaoise Harbour, Wick, in 1811 gave a tremendous impetus to the whole Scottish herring fishing period. Then there was the discovery of the new Scotch Cure in 1819. That came about as a result of a competition sponsored by the Art Society of London, when they offered a reward for the best method of securing quality herring to a standard equal to or higher than the secret Dutch cure. Period. J.F. Donovan of Leith claimed the reward, and he was paid 50 guineas. The Scotch cure provided a breakthrough to successful large-scale herring fishing in Scotland. Newfoundland. The state recognised the value of the British fishery industry, not only for the considerable wealth it was capable of generating, but more particularly as a training ground for large numbers of recruits for the mercantile marine as well as the Royal Navy. New paragraph. Then there was the invention of the loom that was capable of weaving cotton gill nets in 1850 by James Patterson of Musselburgh. The new nets were less bulky and the boats could carry more of them, thereby increasing their catching power. Before that, nets were handmade in the homes of the people from Hempyarn. Reverend Hugh Monroe, parish minister of Hugh Lewis, states in the first statistical account about 1795 that there were 275 net makers in the Oog parish at that time period. Our Calvost Cayley House host Angus Morrison related to us how his contemporary Kenneth Nicholson 11 Calvost, my grandfather, was assisting his father in the making of new hemp nets at home when he was asked to assist the civil engineers to measure the crofts at the time of the second blotting about 1850-52. New paragraph. One fundamental difference between the Dutch cure and the Scotch cure was that whereas the Dutch cured their herring at sea after first drowsing it in salt, the British insisted on the herring submitted for curing being newly caught and absolutely fresh. Salt was not allowed near the fish before it was landed because it tended to soften the fish. Also, fishery officers were appointed by the British to monitor the quality of the product. A system of applying a crown brand to the barrels of cured herring by the fishery officer was adopted. All barrels had to be uniform in size, and each barrel was marked with the date that the fish was cured, the name and address of the curer, and the name of the fishery officer that applied the crown brand. The Crown brand also selected the British herring into various categories as follows. Large full, full, Matty's full, spent and mixed. Large full were herring with a roe or milt not less than 11.25 inches long. Full were herring with roe or milt not less than 10.25 inches long. Matty's full were herring with roe or milt clearly seen at the throat and not less than 9.25 inches long. Spent not less than 10.25 inches long. Period. The Scotch cure and the Crown brand set the quality standard for herring cured in Scotland, and that generated confidence and satisfaction among the buyers. Very soon, the British cured herring gained a reputation for being the best in the world. A picture of the of the Crown Band. New paragraph. Fishing boats were being improved during the whole of the 19th century, but in the 1840s, the fleet still consisted mainly of open boats of the five and scuffy design period. By 1848, there were some half-decked, but very few full-decked boats in use when the big drowning disaster occurred at Wick, Bahagmore Wick, when 41 boats and 37 men were lost while they were trying to enter the harbour during a severe storm that caught the fishing fleet at sea. New paragraph. Following the Wick drowning disaster, the government set up a board of inquiry, and one of their most important recommendations was that more fully decked boats should be built. Period. However, like most other innovations, the idea of fully decked boats was received with skepticism at first by many fishermen who felt that such boats would be clumsy and unworkable. New paragraph. Experiments were taking place to find a more suitable fishing boat for the conditions that existed around the north of Scotland. Period. It was in 1879 that Ashers, as it was, Ashers Boatyard in Burghead, B-U-R-G-H-E-A-D, achieved a breakthrough with a new design which was dubbed Sulu, because the Sulu War in South Africa was raging then. Period. The newly designed boat incorporated the best features of the old and tried scuffy and five boats. It retained the straight stem of the fivey and the raking stern of the scuffy. Best of all, new paragraph. Best of all, these powerful Sulu boats, of an overall length of 75 to 80 feet and a draught of 7 to 9 feet aft, had a powerful steam capstan, which was operated by an upright steam boiler installed in the crew cabin directly below the steam capstan. These boats carried a lot of canvas, and the least puff of wind gave them steerage way. Period. The fishermen felt that the Sulu design fishing boat was the answer to their prayer. The last of the Sulu class of fishing boats was the Monarch SY486, which was scrapped in Lewes in the mid-1940s. Then there is Oran Daisy and a picture of a Sulu fishing boat with two sails and a jib. New paragraph. The transition from the age of the sail to mechanical power in fishing boats in Lewes came in gradually over the first 30 years of the 20th century. First came the steam drifter about the end of the 19th century, some 20 years after the Sulu sailboat. Period. Nearly all the steam drifters were built between 1900 and 1914. They were expensive to run on coal, whereas sailboats incurred no expense while at sea. Period. Also, a steam drifter cost £2,500 to buy, whereas a large 80-foot Sulu sailboat only cost about £700 to buy new. Period. The steam drifter was, however, a very comfortable boat, and eventually there were quite a number of them in Lewes. There were two of them in Cremorne. New paragraph. During the First World War, the government took control of the fishing fleet and used many of the larger boats as naval auxiliaries, vessels. Naval auxiliary vessels, period. The steam drifter Herring Fisher, owned by the fish curers Messrs. Duncan McKeever Limited Stormy, was enlisted in the patrol service section of the RNRT, Royal Naval Reserve Trawler Section, including her skipper, Tom Rogues, Matheson Aird Point. Also, McFarlane Marivic served on her as mate, although he was nearly 60 years of age then. They were based in Scapa Flow, but ranged as far as the Mediterranean. New Pelican. In the 1920s, the sail fishing fleet in Lewis were converted to motor by installing small marine engines in them. Period. The peak year of the herring fishing in Scotland was 1907, when 2.5 million barrels of cured herring was processed. Period. In 1913, there were 3,500 fisher girls from the Western Isles at the East Anglia winter herring fishing season, which lasted from September to December. New Pelican. It was in the early 1900s that these movements of herring cutters and hired crew hands reached their height. However, as late as 1936, there were still 1,000 Western Isles fisher girls at the East Anglia fishing, as well as many hired boat hands. Picture of a drifter, steam drifter. For over 100 years, hired hands and fisher girls from the Hebrides went to the Scottish and English herring fishing until the Second World War, which put an end to all that forever because tastes and markets changed. New Pelican. Boats from the Western Isles went to the East Anglia herring fishing as well, and skipper Alexander MacLeod Knock Point made a record-breaking homecoming voyage from East Anglia in 1899 in the Sulu sailboat Morven and Warvian SY1217, the boat he had before the Monarch. He covered the distance of about 500 miles from Lowestoft to Stornoway non-stop in 48 hours. Then there's a picture of the girls in Stornoway cutting the herring. New Pelican. When Martin visited Stornoway about 1700, he said there were only 60 families there at that time. Some 80 years later, when John Knox visited Stornoway in 1786, he commented that they were sorry to see that noble port without a quay. The vessels had to load and unload upon the beach or in the bay by means of small boats, period. Local oral tradition in our village, Keighley House, still spoke of the time when there were few quays in Stornoway and fish was landed on the beach or carried in baskets over a row of boats. New Pelican. An old map dated about 1785 shows a number of small loose stone jetties in the inner harbour, similar to that which may still be seen in many Lewis villages. The only pier on that map was suitable for fairly large vessels was situated at the corner of North Beach and Esplanade Road. It was known as the Big key. New paragraph. Seaforth Mackenzie, the Lewis proprietor, encouraged the people of Stornoway to build small private stone keys by including a condition in their few charters obliging viewers to build such stone keys on their land. New paragraph. The present town of Stornoway evolved by combining three or four small villages. The original village of Stornoway lay in the peninsula area between North and South Beach. The village of Bayhead was in the present Bayhead area, and the village of Newton, with landholding stretching backwards from the Newton foreshore. A fourth village called Ranall, or Ranall, where the castle grounds are at present, was cleared by Sir James Malston in order to make way for the castle and castle policies. New paragraph. After Sir James Malston acquired the island in 1844, he introduced the first steamboat regular service to the mainland, and he built what was then known as the Steamer Quay. The Steamer Quay, not far from where the previous roll-on, roll-off car ferry ramp stood near the King's Lamp Bombreed. Apart from these two quays, the rest of the Stornoway foreshore was substantially in its natural undeveloped state in the middle of the 19th century. An old bark called Amity, A-M-I-T-Y, was beached on the west beach by Sir James Matheson opposite the old custom house, which is now the building known as Amity House. That wreck was also used as a keep. New Parliament. Early in the 1860s, the people of Stornoway felt that the port and the whole Lewis community were not able to take full advantage of the excellent opportunities then available in the herring fishing industry in Scotland because of the lack of proper harbour facilities in Stornoway, the main market town in the island. Period. Accordingly, they appealed to the Member of Parliament, who was none other than the Lewis proprietor, Sir James Matheson, to promote parliamentary legislation that would enable them to establish a public harbour authority for the town. New paragraph. It transpired that Sir James himself had personal ambitions to acquire the whole foreshore of Stornoway Bay, from Arnish Point right round to Holland Point, and he secured the ownership of the whole foreshore of Stornoway in 1863. Period. True to type, Sir James took steps through his despotic estate factor, Donald Munro, as soon as he secured effective power to harass and deprive the town's folk of their private peers and prevent them from exercising their rights to use their peers for fish curing and a source of income. New paragraph. If he had been successful, it is reasonable to assume that the history of the fishing industry in Lewis might have been very different, and so would the history of the whole Lewis community. New paragraph. However, there were public-spirited men in Stornoway at that time, and they stood up to Sir James and called public meetings and set up a provisional committee in order to promote the best interests of the community and the development of the fishing industry. Period. A heated dispute followed which became known at the time as the foreshore question. Presently, Sir James asked the Court of Session to declare that he had sole and exclusive rights in the foreshore and the piers without interference by the other parties that claimed rights to the keys, and these parties should hand over to him any dues levied and the substantial balance that had accumulated in the key account period. The townspeople organized a petition and mandate from the people to carry their case to Parliament period. Among those that signed the petition were 16 fish tuners, 13 coopers and 36 fishermen, which indicates the extent of fishing activity in Stornoway in the 1860s. New paragraph. In 1864, the Court of Session case was withdrawn, and Sir James Matheson cooperated with the Stornoway people. In 1865, the Pier and Harbour Commission was incorporated by Act of Parliament, and undoubtedly it was the development of harbour facilities at Stornoway that was the most important single factor in the growth of the town, as well as the ensuing prosperity of the fishing industry in Lewis, New Paragraph. Stornoway was late in the harbour and herring fishing development race, but from 1865 onwards, the development of Stornoway Harbour was dramatic. No time was lost by the newly constituted Harbour Commission to procure a harbour order and commence to develop the foreshore, a 150-foot timber wharf, known later as Number 1 Wharf, and a 350-foot masonry quay wall to the west, replacing the wharf of the wreck, replacing the wreck of the Amity at Esplanade Road, etc., as well as the reclamation and infilling of the space behind Quay and Amity, making that area available for fish curing period. Also, the provision of buildings, sheds and warehouses for the improvement of the harbour. New paragraph. All that was in the 1860s programme. And by 1881 and 1892, further harbour development works were put in hand. Again in the late 1920s, a new harbour order was confirmed, authorising work which was carried out from 1930 to 1934. During all that time, the Stornoway Pier and Harbour Commission provided the rapidly expanding herring fishing industry with suitable harbour facilities, even ahead of their requirements, and they are still developing harbour facilities. New paragraph. In the 19th century, Stornoway owned a considerable fleet of trading vessels, as well as a fishing fleet. Her ships sailed the seven seas, period, also shipbuilding and repairing and ancillary trades were important, period. The population of Lewis rose steadily during the whole of the 19th century as follows. And then put four headings down. First census, and then population, then increase, and then percentage. Under census, starting at 1801, population 9,168. Then 1811 census, population 10,092, plus, that's a plus of 924 increase. and a plus of 10.1%. 1821, 12,291 population, a plus of 2,139, or 21.2%. 1831, 14,541, a plus of 2,310, or 18.9%. 1841, 17,037 population, a plus of 2,496, which was equal to 17.2%. Next line, 1851, which was 19,711, a plus of 2,624, or 15.7%. Next line, 1861, giving 21,056, a plus of 1,345, or 6.8%. Next line, 1871, 23,483, a plus of 2,427, or 11.5%. Next line, 1881, a plus of 25,000, a population of 25,487, a plus of 2,004, or 8.5%. In 1891, 27,590, a plus of 2,103, or 8.3%. In 1901, population of 28,949, a plus of 1,359, or 4.9%. In 1911, which was peak, 29,000 population 603, a plus of 654, or 2.3%. Thereafter, decline during the whole of the 20th century. From the fisherman's point of view, fishing was profitable during the early years of the 20th century, 1900 to 1914. The First World War destroyed our continental markets for cured herring, such as Germany, the Baltic States, and Russia. And with the exception of 1927-28, when there was an unusual flood of herring in Loch Eresford, to the extent that one could gather the herring in buckets on the foreshore right from Loch Eresford. The years between the two world wars were a failure as far as fishing was concerned, and herring fishing was concerned. New Palace. Most of the Hebridean fishermen were naval reservists, and they had to abandon their boats during the First and the Second World Wars, and by the time they returned their boats were derelict. And in the late 1940s and 50s, the whole fishing fleet were replaced by purpose-built boats, and then came new methods of fishing. Gill nets were abandoned, and ring nets, trawl nets, etc. were adopted, resulting eventually in overfishing of herring and a total ban on any form of fishing for herring in 1977. After waiting for nearly 2 years for the uplifting of the herring fishing ban, the MacLennan brothers of Marwick, who had the distinction of being the last crew who fished with the environmentally friendly gill nets, with their purpose-built motorboat Seafarer SY210, had to give up and sell out. That marked the end of the gill net herring fishing. The ban on herring fishing was not lifted until 1983. And from then on, it was the trawling method that was used for catching fish. By that time, the young generation were no longer accustomed to herring, on the menu, and the market demand dropped very considerably. Then there's a picture of the Hamarvi boat, seafarer, SY210.